Shalom uvracha, and welcome to the Marshall Portnoy Show. Good morning, everyone. This is Marshall Portnoy, and today we are going to talk about water. It's essential for life, and essential as well as a building block of our faith and tradition. As the British science writer Philip Ball says, water is life's true and unique medium. Without water, life simply cannot be sustained. It is the fluid that lubricates the workings of the cell, transporting the materials and molecular machinery from one place to another, and facilitating the chemical reactions that keep us going. Water is sustenance, bearing nutrients to where they are needed. It is even a structural agent in plants. It enables flowers to hold up their heads to the sun. No wonder we would quickly die without it, for we need to consume at least 2 pints a day for long-term health. For whether you are a scorpion or a cucumber, a salmonella bacterium or a bull elephant, water is literally your life. Or maybe the Bible said it best, Mayim Chayim, water is life.
Watch the mountain fire, make the sunlight turn the world around. Heart is of the river, body is the mountain, spirit is the sunlight, turn the world around. We are of the spirit, truly of the spirit, only can the spirit turn the world around. We are of the spirit, truly of the spirit, only can the spirit turn the world around.
So is life. As Harry Belafonte says, we come from the water. When we are born, we come from the water, and when we emerge from a body of living water called a mikveh, It's like being reborn. Perhaps that is why the word mikvah has the same Hebrew root as the word tikva, meaning hope. We are born in optimism and hope, and we draw strength from mikveh mayim, the gathering of waters. This is Marshall Portnoy on WWDB AM 860. Do you know what a mikvah is? Well, if you don't, I have exactly the person to whom you will want to listen. And if you do know what a mikvah is, you're going to find out a lot more about it. I am with Lori Cooper. Lori is in charge of the mikvah at Temple Beth Hillel, Beth El, in Wynwood, Pennsylvania. And Lori, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We have listeners who are not Jewish, as well as Jewish listeners and so forth. People may want to know, what is a mikvah?
A mikvah is a ritual bath. It dates back to nearly over, actually, 3,000 years during the time before the temple, the ancient temple in Jerusalem. It is used during times, during moments of change, during times of transition and transformation. But it was used 3,000 years ago before the Jewish people would go to pray at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem.
So do all Jewish communities have a mikveh?
So there are three things that a Jewish community needs to have, and that, according to tradition, and that is a burial society, the Chevra Kedisha. It needs to have a library, and it needs to have a mikveh.
So the existence of a mikveh, the existence of a library, that would be an important index as to whether there was a viable community in that perhaps ancient city or perhaps a city even more recent.
Yes. Wherever you would go in the world, you would find a mikveh. Whenever I go on travels, I find a mikveh. Outside of the old city, you can find of Jerusalem, you can find hundreds of mikvehs. In order to go to inside to pray at the Temple Mount, you needed to go into a mikveh to purify yourself.
Does a mikveh have to be of a certain dimension, or can it be just as large or small as...
The mikveh itself doesn't really have... the actual mikveh pool does not have regulations. What is regulated, what is according to needs to be built, is the collection of water it is an essential part of the mikveh. The water that is put into, that is used for a mikveh, needs to flow directly as it rains into the actual mikveh pool. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes a mikveh. It needs to be rainwater, fresh water, that flows directly into the pool.
So this mikveh here, as I'm sitting with you in Wynnewood, Pennsylvania, this mikveh actually receives direct rainwater from heaven.
Exactly, exactly. That's and it's no coincidence that we think of birth and renewal and rejuvenation when we go into a mikveh, because water is life. Water is the beginning. The primordial waters of creation, that's what we have in our mikveh to help us, remind us of who we are, where we came from, and then to start over again.
It's beautiful. Okay, Lori, who uses the mikveh? What are the different universes or populations of people that make use of the mikveh, either on a regular basis or on a once-in-a-lifetime basis?
Okay. Traditionally, the mikveh is used for a number of purposes. It's used before marriages. It's used before conversion, during the conversion process. It is used monthly for women to mark their menstrual cycles. And it's used before holidays and Shabbat, the Sabbath. We at our mikveh have decided to use our mikveh in new ways, in untraditional ways. And we use it for healing. And we use it for celebration.
Is the mikveh used exclusively by or mainly by women?
I think people have thought that, if they know anything about mikveh, they have thought that women are the ones who use the mikveh. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, a mikveh is used, as I said earlier, during times of transition and transformation. So men go through just as many transitions and transformations as women do. I have a number of men who come before the Sabbath. I have almost as many grooms that come to the mikveh before their wedding as I do brides.
Ah, interesting.
So, and then conversions, you know, people, there are men and women who convert to Judaism.
Tell us about this particular mikveh at Beth Hillel, Bethel.
Well, the important thing to know about our mikveh is we aren't a conservative mikveh. We are housed at a conservative synagogue, but we're a community mikveh.
Mm-hmm.
We built our mikveh so that all Jews and all those becoming Jewish would have a place to immerse.
If people should want to support this important community cause, and as you say, it is one of the three pillars of what defines a Jewish community, how may they do so?
Our website is The Mikveh, M-I-K-V-E-H.
So
T-H-E-M-I-K-V-E-H dot webs, that's W-E-B-S, dot com. Really, mikveh is about immersion, but it's also just as much about emergence. When we emerge from a mikveh, we feel renewed, reborn, ready to start again.
That sounds absolutely beautiful. Lori, if it's all right, may I tell our listeners who your famous brother is?
If you have to.
Well, I'll tell you what, in your honor, we're going to go out from this segment with another one of his pieces of music, but a friend and colleague and greatly to be admired in the field of Jewish music, you tell us about your brother.
My brother is Craig Taubman. He is a Jewish songwriter and performer, and he lives in Los Angeles, and he's just a terrific guy.
Lori, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the air today. Many people don't know about mikveh, and it's certainly an important community support, has been for thousands of years, but maybe a very important individual spiritual support as well. And I think just meeting you and visiting the mikveh, are people allowed to just come and tour and visit and meet you?
Absolutely. I have classes quite often, and I also have people who call me and say, can I see your mikveh? And maybe this will fit into my life.
What's the number if people should want to call, Lori?
The number is 610-642-9844.
610-642-9844. for. Lori, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's
been
great.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Be well.
Hashkiveinu Adonai Eloheinu Leshalom Vehamideinu Malkeinu Lechaim Hashkiveinu Adonai Eloheinu Leshalom Vehamideinu Malkeinu Lechaim Shalom, v'hamideinu malkeinu lechayim. Hashkiveinu Adonai, Eloheinu leshalom, v'hamideinu malkeinu lechayim. Hashkiveinu Adonai, Eloheinu leshalom, v'hamideinu malkeinu. Hashkiveinu Adonai Eloheinu leshalom Behamideinu malkeinu lechayim
This is Marshall Portnoy at WWDBAM 860. I want to talk to you about the year 1885 for reasons that will become clear in just a moment. 1885, Charles Dow published the first edition of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It was at $63 and it represented 14 companies, 12 of which were railroads, if you can believe it. The Statue of Liberty arrived in New York Harbor. President Chester A. Arthur dedicated the Washington Monument in February, and the following month, Grover Cleveland was inaugurated President of the United States, which is the month that they did it back then. But another thing happened in 1885, and that was the founding of S. Berkowitz and Son Women's Clothing. And do you believe it? It's still going on today. How many stores or businesses can you name that are still thriving 133 years later? But it is in its fifth generation still serving smart women who want to be smart and look smart. You're smart to go to S. Berkowitz because you know that you're going to get the finest designer quality for the best value. Their secret is personal service. When you go into S. Berkowitz or even just call them on the telephone, they'll instinctively know what it is you need, what you have in mind, in terms of the look that you want. They're located at 362 Montgomery Avenue in Marion, just a few minutes from City Avenue, and their phone number is 610-664-6645. Well, their address may have changed. They're no longer at South and 6th as they were 100 years ago, but their commitment to quality and fashion has not altered one jot. The number again, 610-664-6645. S. Berkowitz and sons and grandsons and great-grandsons. S. Berkowitz, the Mecca for the modern woman.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Mm-hmm.
Well, that music means it's birthday time on the Marshall Portnoy Show, and a chance for one lucky listener to win a gift certificate to Jaime's Marion Deli. And today, not a singer, but an instrumentalist. So please call and identify this musician before the end of this wonderful song. Call 888-329-3306. Name the musician and the instrument. You have to name the musician and the instrument. Again, that's 888-329-3306 and win a Jaime's gift certificate. Song. And I have Jay in Northeast Philadelphia. That was the first light on the call-in line here at WWDB 860 AM. Good morning, Jay. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for listening to the Marshall Portnoy Show. And do you have any idea who that was?
Yeah, I think it's Kenny G.
You're absolutely right, Jay. And you have to tell me the instrument that he is playing.
Saxophone.
You've got it. And you've got a gift certificate to Jaime's Marion Deli. Any summer plans this year, Jay, that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, well, I go down the shore a lot to Margate and trying to just hope it gets a little warmer and enjoy the weather.
You have a wonderful summer, Jay. We so appreciate your calling the show. Your answer was 100% spot on, and you'll be receiving a gift certificate to Jaime's Marion Deli. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Yes, that was Kenny G, as Jay identified very correctly. Born June 5th in 1956 in Seattle, Washington, but he wasn't called Kenny G when he was born. He was called Kenneth Bruce Gorelick. We know him as Kenny G, one of the best-selling recording artists of all time. Listen to this, selling close to 100 million. Can you believe that? 100 million records and sound files. He lives in Malibu, California. By the way, he loves golf, at which he also excels. Speaking of excellence, stay tuned, folks. Don't touch that dial. This is Marshall Portnoy at WWDB AM 860. It's my pleasure to be here with our chief Yiddishist. We have Chef Jane, but we have a chief Yiddishist.
That's funny.
And that's Rita Ratson. Rita,
so nice to be here. Thank you.
Always great to have you. And you were telling me about a wonderful event that you went to yesterday. There's nothing more wonderful than watching your grandchild
right.
perform. And what was that all about?
When you talk about your grandchild, get a big smile on your face. It
sure
is wonderful.
Do.
Well, what was that about? My youngest grandchild, who was 11, is a Maydala little girl, mm-hmm. and she performed in her recital. She's a dancer, and so it was Azan Nachas. Such great joy. When you say Nachas, it's more joy than saying it in English.
And in Hebrew, Nachat means pleasure.
That's exactly
same,
right.
Same thing. How do you say granddaughter?
Einiko.
And grandson?
Einik, with a K on the end.
Or Einik, Einiko. Let's do a little bit of grammar. My grandson is dancing.
Mein Einik tanzt.
My granddaughter is dancing.
Mein Einikel tanzt.
So there is no difference, as there would be in French or Portuguese, as far as the verb is concerned. A male dancing, a female dancing, it's the same in the verb. My grandson danced.
Mein Einik hat getanzt.
So hot is
past tense.
What is hot? Has danced?
Has danced or did dance, but you can't say the past tense without that word has or did, or well, translates it did.
So the imperfect or the past perfect or any kind of past tense requires the word hot.
Yes.
Okay. And so
it's called the auxiliary verb.
Okay. Same thing in many other languages. So my granddaughter danced again.
Mein Enkel hat getanzt.
My grandson danced.
Mein Enkel hat getanzt.
My granddaughter will dance.
Mein Enkel wird tanzen.
Okay, and my grandson, mein Enkel
wird tanzen.
Wird tanzen, so same thing.
Yes.
Are there any other verbs? We've had past, present, future. Is there, for example, in Yiddish, a pluperfect, like my daughter had danced until she reached the age of 12 or something like that?
That takes the same
form. Thing.
It's two forms that are used only in one way in Yiddish and two forms in English.
And my grandson will have danced, as if he will have been in the ballet for 20 years this spring or something like that. Same thing.
It's the same thing.
Vet.
Yes,
vet okay.
Tanzen.
But understanding from context, that's
exactly.
How we translate. Okay. Where did your granddaughter do this dance?
Well, you know, for your grandchildren, you will travel wherever you have to.
You bet.
Traveled, it was nearly an hour from our house to Souderton, PA. And it's a very large high school that they use the stage there. And no matter where it is you live, you need to travel that far to see your Ainsenickel tanzen.
Okay, so I am traveling to see my granddaughter.
The word traveling. So in Yiddish, the word to, we say in English, I'm going. You'd say more often going than you say traveling.
Okay, right.
So the same word in Yiddish, forn, F-O-R-N, as you might hear it in English. Forn is to travel. Fliehen is to fly. Gehen is to go or to walk.
So if someone called you on the telephone yesterday morning and said, what are you doing today? Oh, I'm going to see my granddaughter dance. How would you say that?
Okay. Mir gehen zusammen unser Ainsenickel tanzen.
So the question
would be, where do you have to go? Therefore, the person talking to me would know, am I walking or am I riding in some form of transportation?
Let's break that down just a little bit. I'm going to see my granddaughter dance again.
Mir forn sehen unser Ainsenickel tanzen.
Mir, I, forn.
Mir is we.
We,
mir
you and your husband.
We,
okay.
Yes. Mir forn,
make,
we
just,
are.
Just to make it easy, I am going to see my granddaughter dance.
Ich gehe or ich for tanzen, sehen mein Ainsenickel tanzen. Because in the word that you are expressing, will your form of travel or walking is specific to how you are going there, or telling my conversationalist, the person who's I'm talking with, how far it is I'm going or what mode of transportation I'm taking. You don't just say go, because it doesn't mean anything in the Yiddish context. You're traveling. So then you're saying, how are you going? I guess 100 years ago, I would have said, I'm taking my horse and wagon.
Right.
Or if it's winter, you would take your sled because it's snowing. But in today's life, still you say, Fahren is a transportation, some mode of transportation. And if you say, Ich gehe, that means I'm walking. It's not the equivalent of the English, I'm going.
Okay. So very beautifully explained. So again, giving us the sentence, I am going, I'm traveling to see my granddaughter dance.
Ich fahre sehen mein Ainsenickel tanzen.
Zane?
Zane, to see.
To see mein
Ainsenickel, my grandchild, tanzen, to dance.
Thank you for being on the show today, Rita. We learned an awful lot.
It's
in
my
a very
pleasure.
Short time. Thanks so much. Today's show is all about, well, Rita would call it, Rita Wasser, right? Okay, I thought water. And when we think about water, we think about the lack of it in many parts of the world, particularly Israel and the Middle East. The need for water may prove to be a challenge in many parts of the world, but we are focused now on Israel because there is a drought there that has obliged the government for 5 years to urge limiting the use of water. The Sea of Galilee is at an all-time low. Some aspects of the water situation are very challenging, although Israel has developed incredible technology that is removing salt from water and making just about anything into water, including thin air. So I'm fortunate today to be able to speak with Andrew Lavin, spokesperson for American Associates of Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. And very appropriately for this show, because Ben-Gurion University of the Negev is doing so much in that area. And Andy tells me that the Negev is the happening place in Israel right now.
So I'm fortunate now to have Andrew Lavin on the program. Andy, how are you? And thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Andy, as I referenced, we hear all of these dire forecasts about water in Israel, the Near East, Africa, and so on. How bad is it?
Well, Israel is different than most of the Middle East. Israel has actually an abundance of water because of the technology that they developed and government-mandated conservation and focus on developing their technology of water.
So no fear of the Sea of Galilee being dried up and seeing islands in the middle of it and all that sort of thing?
Well, so I guess you have to separate it. Does Israel have enough water to drink and to irrigate their crops? They now have an abundance of it. But is the Dead Sea drying up and is the Sea of Galilee shrinking? Absolutely. But those are two different issues.
Okay, so talk about that. I know that the question of the Dead Sea is a result of irrigation and so forth. Is that ultimately harming the Holy Land or helping?
Well, anytime you use up a natural resource, it has significant consequences. There is talk, and I think planning is going forward, on reintroducing water from the Red Sea back into the Dead Sea. It's called the Dead Sea Project.
And wow.
A large driver of that is because there are significant potash facilities on both the Jordanian side and on the Israeli side. So there needs to be water to maintain those industries, and so that is one of the things that they're talking about doing. But Ben-Gurion University, actually, and their researchers have studied what happens when you put lower salinity water from the Red Sea into a very high salinity environment, which is the Dead Sea. And that has all kinds of consequences as well.
How do things look for Israel's neighbors in terms of this water challenge?
Well, again, it's a mixed bag. Israel is the only country, I think, in on the earth where the desert is actually receding. And everywhere else, the desertification of the globe is becoming a major issue. Israel shares water underground with Jordanians. They keep their water in an aquifer with the Palestinians. Water, unlike pipes and fences, is something that transcends borders.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to share it. And Israel and Jordan have an agreement to share water. With all of the conflicts that have gone on since the creation of Israel, since the water treaties have been signed,
mm-hmm.
they've been maintained, and there is a very strict code of regulations on how water is shared.
So Israel has the opportunity of creating, we won't call it a modern-day Marshall Plan, but a sort of modern-day water plan, where they can help their neighbors and further the cause of peace.
And let me give you a few examples.
Please.
Of Israel's helping neighbors. For example, at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, there's the Zuckerberg Institute for Water Research, and they have been training Jordanian students and sending them back to help develop the infrastructure and help develop more sustainable agriculture in Jordan. They host a conference sponsored by the United Nations, one of the few UN events that take place in Israel, and researchers from countries that really have no formal relations with Israel send their scientists. And I've met Palestinian water researchers and the water authority people at a conference when I was there. So Israel is sharing its know-how and its technology to help all of their neighbors. And they send researchers to Africa to develop water, to drill wells, educate the population about how to use water more efficiently, and to help educate children about the waterborne diseases and infection and how it's unsafe to drink water that's brackish.
Well, kol hakavod to Israel. Of course, you'd expect nothing less from our state. Tell us a little bit about Andy Lavin. What is your work in connection with Israel? I know you've made 18 visits to Israel, which is marvelous.
My relationship is with the American Associates Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, and I've been working with them on building awareness for all of the great work that the university does in Israel, bringing technology from the desert for the world. And it's really a labor of love. And we get to work on so many interesting cutting-edge technologies. We work with some of the best researchers and help them communicate what they're doing in all kinds of fields, in water. You know, desalination was invented at Ben-Gurion University, and now today we're working on developing better membranes for desalination, and we're also working on nanomaterials that help with filtration for water. And as I said before, we're sending our researchers to Africa and working with our neighbors and helping to develop the technology so that others can use it.
Andy, can you tell us a little bit about the historical and inspirational origin of Ben-Gurion University? I know it's literally has quite a bit to do with David Ben-Gurion, our first prime minister, but please talk about that.
Ben-Gurion University of the Negev was founded on David Ben-Gurion's dream to develop the Negev Desert land, because there was a limited amount of land in the north, and vast amounts of land, because there was a limited amount of land in the north. In the south. And he ultimately established a home in the Negev, and leaders would come visit him and drive to the middle of nowhere to his kibbutz at Sde Boker, and he really helped fulfill the science and technology initiatives that were required to accomplish this. So Israel developed drip irrigation so that they could grow crops in the desert. And today, if you go through the Negev, there are hundreds of greenhouses dotting the landscape where all kinds of plants and fish are being cultivated, and they're shipped all over the world. Native water issues are absolutely real and absolutely significant. From a drinking water and from an agricultural point of view, Israel is in fabulous shape.
That's so great. Andy, please tell our listeners how they might be able to support, learn more about what Ben-Gurion University is doing with water and other challenges in Israel and the Middle East, and just support the university and the area in general.
First of all, if your listeners would like to learn more about Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, or would like to donate or find donation opportunities for U.S. donors, they would go to aabgu.org, and that stands for American Associates Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. We have 9 regional offices around the country and 1 right in Philadelphia.
Andrew Lavin, it has been a pleasure. You are a delight, and it's been a pleasure to have you on the show today and shed so much light and a balanced view on the subject of water in Israel and the Middle East. I hope you'll be on the show again with us.
It would be our pleasure.
Okay.
just so interesting to talk to Andy Lavin. And I want to repeat that internet address, because Ben-Gurion University of the Negev does such good, and it's just good to be in touch with them and keep current with all that they're doing. AABGU.org website, American Associates, Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. So good also to get a nice email from Kenny G. Obviously could not be on the show today. He's in Malibu. But back again, here's Kenny G. Must have been like for Kenny G to play that saxophone with Louis Armstrong. It must have made quite an impression on him. Well, you know what they say about first impressions. You have only one chance to make one. And listeners, your hair defines so much about your appearance and the impressions that you do make on other people. And that's why I want to talk to you about Raya Coiffure on Haverford Station Road. The minute you walk in, your first impression is that you're in a very special place. And that's the same care they take with your appearance. One customer, I think, said it best. Raya, she said, is not a stylist. She's an artist. And there are so many artisans there who can give you exactly the look you want. Dignified and stately. Wild child, a little bit alternative. Dainty during the day, a tad daring at dusk. Just right for that first meeting with a client or a date. You'll find your stylist at Raya Coiffure, and you'll find yourself as well. 610-645-0707 to find yourself and the hairstyle in which you shine. Call that number, 610-645-0707. Raya Haig, not hair today and gone tomorrow. Hair today, hair for always. This is Marshall Portnoy with WWDB AM 860. We're doing water today, and I am in the kitchen with Chef Jane. And that idea of water probably led you to think about something with liquid or drinks or something like that?
Right. The time of year and the idea of water led me to the idea of some summer drinks. So I thought we could talk about sangria, which is a nice, refreshing summer drink. And can be made with many different types of fruits. I mean, there's so many theme and variations. For instance, the red wine sangria, which is sort of the traditional sangria, is made usually with red wine and citrus fruits. And then there are many variations. Some people would make a white wine sangria with summer fruits, such as peaches and nectarines. I've had a blackberry sangria with a blackberry liqueur and blackberry syrup, which is absolutely delicious too. So I thought I would just mention two possibilities. The ingredients are not set in stone. You can really adjust the ingredients to your taste. You may like it less sweet. You might like it a little more sweet.
So my taste would be standing outside in a late afternoon, maybe Father's Day, with a drink in my hand, and that drink might be sangria. That sounds wonderful. What is sangria? Is it that Greece? Am I thinking Greek or...
Sangria is usually a Spanish drink.
Oh, Spain.
And right. Traditionally made with red wine and citrus fruits.
That sounds so good.
So I thought I would maybe talk about a traditional recipe for a red wine sangria and then mention a possible white wine sangria. The ingredients are variable and can be adjusted to your taste depending on how sweet you like it. So I'll just give you a little template. Which is definitely variable. So, for instance, for a red wine sangria, you can take the juice of two oranges, and fresh orange juice is preferable, obviously, and then one orange thinly sliced and one lemon thinly sliced. And you can pour that or put that fruit into a large pitcher. Then I dissolve a quarter of a cup of sugar in a quarter of a cup of orange liqueur, that could be a Cointreau or a Grand Marnier, just to dissolve the sugar, and then add a bottle of a light red wine, such as a Merlot. And then mix all those ingredients together. You add about 2 cups of ice and mix that, and then put it in the refrigerator for about 1 to 2 hours so that all the flavors can blend. And then when it's ready, serve it in wine glasses filled with ice, and you can garnish it with an orange slice or a little sprig of mint.
It sounds so delicious. Is there a reason why you would choose either the red wine sangria or the white about your menu or anything like that?
I think sometimes it has to do with the fruit also. I think of the citrus with the red wine. In the summer with the white wine sangria, if we have ripe peaches or nectarines, I like to use white wine for that. And I prefer white wine myself. So for myself, I just prefer white wine, but that's, again, personal taste. So for the white wine sangria, you take about 3 ripe peaches or nectarines and 1 pint of sliced strawberries and 1/4 cup of sugar and 1/4 cup of, again, a liqueur, an orange liqueur that you might have around a Cointreau or a Grand Marnier. Most people don't have a peach liqueur. You could use that instead. You could even add a little bit of peach nectar. Again, that's not something we normally have around the house. And then a bottle of a light white wine, such as a Sauvignon Blanc. And those Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand are very, very nice. And again, the same thing. You want to dissolve the sugar in the liqueur. Add that to a large pitcher. You want to add the fruit, the peaches or nectarines and the strawberries to the pitcher. You want to add a bottle of your light white wine. If you add a little bit of 1/4 cup of peach nectar, you could add that or even apricot nectar. And then add 2 cups of ice and refrigerate that for a couple of hours. And then serve it over your pretty wine glasses filled with ice. You could also top off these sangrias with some sparkling water if you wanted to. Again, it depends on how concentrated or how diluted you want to make it. So it's all according to taste. But those are just some guidelines, and you can vary it, as I said, according to your whim.
That was delicious. I'm going to look forward to having that on Father's Day. Any chance that might happen?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the white sangria with the peaches and maybe some peach liqueur and a white wine. I think that would be nice.
Thanks so much for being on the show.
You're very welcome.
And thanks so much indeed, Chef Jane. Thanks as well to Yiddishist Rita Ratzin, Lori Cooper of the Mikveh, and Andrew Lavin of American Associates, Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Listeners, we have something very special next week. Next Tuesday would have been Anne Frank's 89th birthday. I'm sure you are aware of the famous play by Frances Goodrich and Albert Hackett based on her diary. That play opened on Broadway in the 50s with a very young Susan Strasberg, was subsequently made into a film with Millie Perkins. What you may not know is that there was another play based on her famous diary, written by the well-known Jewish-American author Meyer Levin. And that set up one of the most virulent, sad, and difficult controversies in 20th century theater history, a controversy which went on for 25 years. Now, you'll actually hear a short scene from that play on next week's show. But there's much more. Believe it or not, there was another young girl who eerily paralleled Anne's life, and, as it happens, who also wrote a diary of the Holocaust. We'll profile Rutka Laskier on next week's show. It's going to be a very special and moving memory of a tragic time. Please tune in to 860 AM or live stream or podcast 24 hours at www.dbam.com. On a much happier note, I want to remind you that in 2 weeks, we'll be joined by Lori, Modern Matchmaker. So send in your questions about life, love, dating, marriage, and relationships to the show at P.O. Box 2786, Ballykinwood, PA 19004. Or email the show with your questions for Lori or comments for Marshall at marshallportnoyshow@gmail.com. That's it for today. This is Marshall Portnoy wishing you shalom uvracha, peace and blessing.